Today is Tuesday, September 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The United Kingdom's Supreme Court ruled on Tuesday that Prime Minister Boris Johnson's decision to shut down Parliament in the run-up to Brexit was unlawful.
The court is bound to conclude, therefore, that the decision to advise Her Majesty to prorogue Parliament was unlawful.
Also ahead, President Trump delivered a speech to the United Nations General Assembly focusing on national sovereignty and individual nations' responsibility for self-defense. Those stories and more coming up. The UK Supreme Court ruled that Prime Minister Boris Johnson's decision to shut down the British Parliament for 5 weeks in the run-up to Brexit was unlawful. Supreme Court President Brenda Hale said the shutdown prevented Parliament from carrying out its constitutional functions.
The court is bound to conclude, therefore, that the decision to advise Her Majesty to prorogue Parliament was unlawful because it had the effect of frustrating or preventing the ability of Parliament to carry out its constitutional functions without reasonable justification.
Anti-Brexit activist Gina Miller called the Supreme Court ruling a win for parliamentary sovereignty and urged Boris Johnson to open the doors to the House of Commons.
Today is not a win for any individual or cause. It's a win for parliamentary sovereignty, the separation of powers and the independence of our British courts. Today's ruling confirms that we are a nation governed by the rule of law. Laws that everyone, even the Prime Minister, is not above. Do not let the government play down the seriousness of the judgment today.
The ruling, which analysts have called a humiliating rebuke to Johnson, thrusts Britain's exit from the European Union into deeper turmoil. Joining me on the phone to discuss how the ruling was received in the UK is Henry Ridgewell. I asked him how the Prime Minister Boris Johnson has reacted to this ruling.
Henry, some analysts have called this ruling a humiliating rebuke to Prime Minister Boris Johnson. How has he reacted to it?
So far, he has remained defiant. He's currently at the United Nations General Assembly in New York, where he has a packed schedule today, including a meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump and a speech later to the Assembly. But he was questioned by media on the court decision and said that he would respect it, but fundamentally disagreed with it. Although pushed further, he did say that he wouldn't rule out trying to suspend Parliament once again, perhaps for a shorter period of time, to try to introduce a new legislative program in Parliament. So certainly it seems he's not going anywhere. He's not going to answer his critics' demands for him to resign. He is due to come back to London on Wednesday, where he will face a vindicated and no doubt confident House of Commons.
Did this come as a surprise to him and to other people in the UK?
It did, I believe, yes. I think most people expected a close result and perhaps a hedged decision by the Supreme Court judges. In the end, the decision was unanimous. All 11 judges who were sitting agreed with the final decision that Boris Johnson had, in effect, misled the Queen. Part of the process of suspending Parliament here is that it is recommended to the Queen to do so by the sitting Prime Minister, and the advice he gave Queen Elizabeth was misleading, and that is a fundamental problem for him, that the courts have ruled that he has misled Parliament. In effect, he lied for his reasons for suspending Parliament, and I think that is the issue that will really stick once all the politics are settled down, once Boris Johnson is back in Parliament. I think his critics will hang on to that decision that he lied to the Queen, who is, of course, still held in very high regard in Britain.
Mm. So then what's the way forward for the UK now as they negotiate Brexit? The deadline is coming up soon, October the 31st, I believe that's the deadline, when Brexit is supposed to take place. Well, what is the way forward?
That's right, Jackson. It is October the 31st, the deadline set when the extension was given by the European Union back in March. Boris Johnson has said he will leave come what may on October the 31st, and he won't be put off either by this court decision or by another piece of legislation that was passed trying to prevent Britain leaving without a deal on that date. So that potentially sets up another clash between the Prime Minister and the law. He could potentially try to defy that piece of legislation. It's not clear whether he's willing to do so yet. And with Parliament and lawmakers returning tomorrow, I think we will see more attempts by rebellious MPs, even in his own party, to influence that Brexit process, perhaps to demand that there is another referendum or to nullify that exit date of October the 31st. Then we have to await the European Union's response as to whether they would themselves give an extension. So I think the briefest answer I can give to your question is, we just don't know. The level of uncertainty is so high at the moment, it's impossible to predict. And I think you're seeing that in the pressure on the British pound, in the pressure on investments, and just generally the economy here in Britain. So much uncertainty, something that investors don't like at all, of course. And we just don't know what's going to happen with the politics either here in London or in Brussels.
Now, the Labour Party was supposed to meet yesterday to vote on their position on this issue. What was the outcome of that vote?
The outcome was essentially that the opposition Labour Party is hedging its bets on Brexit. They face a very difficult dilemma in that many of the seats that they hold in Parliament voted for Brexit, although many of the party's members and most of its MPs are very much against Brexit. So the leader faces the task of trying to hang on to those seats and those voters who support Brexit while having a membership and MPs who are demanding that he endorses remaining in the European Union and takes a much stronger line. So in the end, the leader, Jeremy Corbyn, was able to get his wishes voted through, basically a position that says we will have a general election, we will get in power, we will then negotiate a new deal with the European Union, and then we'll put it to a new referendum. The problem I think Labour will face is that is a very nuanced position to be taking to the doorstep during any general election when you have very straightforward positions on other parties, either very much against Brexit or very much for it.
Mm-hmm. Henry Ridgewell reporting from London. Henry, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me, Jackson.
All right. Bye-bye.
This is International Edition. More than 200 world leaders are in New York for the annual UN General Assembly. Earlier today, U.S. President Donald Trump, who has long opposed globalism and criticized the multilateralism that is the foundation of the United Nations, focused his speech on the need to work collectively within the global community to address global challenges.
The truth is plain to see. If you want freedom, take pride in your country. If you want democracy, hold on to your sovereignty. And if you want peace, love your nation. Wise leaders always put the good of their own people and their own country first. The future does not belong to globalists. The future belongs to patriots. The future belongs to sovereign and independent nations who protect their citizens, respect their neighbors, and honor the differences that make each country special and unique.
VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir joins me via phone from the UN headquarters. Hello, Margaret.
Hi, Jackson.
So how was this year's speech different from the two previous ones? And most importantly, what was the Assembly's reaction to his speech, considering that there was laughter last year?
No laughter this year, and in fact, very little applause. No, you know, usually during these speeches, the audience will spontaneously break out into applause after a line or two. There was none of that this year, and in fact, only a bit of applause at the very end. But his tone this year was very different from past years, where he warned of fire and fury on North Korea and things like that. This year, you know, we're moving into the election cycle in the United States. 2020 is around the corner. He's looking for re-election. So he had a message for his domestic audience, but he also had a message for the international audience. And part of it was a warning for America's political and economic adversaries that we're not seeking conflict with any other country, but we won't hesitate to defend America's interests. And he spoke about the U.S.'s military might, how he has rebuilt the military since coming to power, and that he hopes he never has to use it. But he directed a lot of his comments on towards Iran. He's very upset with Iran since the nuclear deal, he pulled out of it, and Iran has been behaving badly in the region. And most recently, we saw on September 14th attacks on two oil installations in Saudi Arabia, which President Trump says the Iranians carried out the attacks. The Iranians say they weren't involved. So he did direct a lot of his comments to Iran. He said they're one of the greatest global threats. They oppose, they oppress their citizens at home, and they fuel conflicts and terrorism beyond their borders. And he said U.S. sanctions would not be lifted. They will be tightened as long as this goes on. But he did leave the door open to diplomacy, and he noted that in the past, some of America's enemies have gone on to become its closest friends. And if you look at World War II, we're very good friends now with Germany and Japan. So I think that was the point he was making, that you don't need to be permanent enemies. And he said the U.S. wants partners, not adversaries.
That was VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir. Margaret, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jackson.
President Donald Trump confirmed that he withheld military aid from Ukraine, saying that he did so over his concerns that the United States was contributing more to Ukraine than European countries were. Trump, who faces increasing pressure from the Democrats to release a whistleblower complaint, denied that he told the president of Ukraine that his country would only get U.S. aid if they investigated the son of Democratic rival Joe Biden. AP's Jackie Quinn has this report.
President Trump says he did call Ukraine's president in July, as a whistleblower has reportedly alleged, but he says there was nothing improper. Trump says he didn't want to give authorized aid to Ukraine if there were corruption issues, suggesting, without evidence, that Joe Biden was involved.
I didn't do it at all. But Joe Biden said it about his son. Joe Biden was very dishonest what he did.
More House Democrats are calling for Trump's impeachment, and several House committees are seeking information from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, threatening subpoenas if he doesn't comply by Thursday, the same day the acting director of National Intelligence is scheduled to testify. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Meanwhile, U.S. Democratic support in Congress for impeachment has reached an all-time high, with 146 Democrats now backing calls for the process to begin. Seven freshman Democrats with previous service in the military, defense, and U.S. intelligence said in a Monday night Washington Post op-ed that if the allegations against Trump are true, quote, "we believe these actions represent an impeachable offense." Joining me to discuss how this story is playing out in Washington is VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden.
So, Jeff, Speaker Nancy Pelosi made it clear this weekend that she would no longer stand for what she called this administration's stonewalling. And in a letter to Republicans and Democrats, she said that if this stonewalling persists, there will be entering a grave new chapter of lawlessness. Does this mean that the speaker is moving closer to joining the chorus of the majority of her caucus in calling for impeachment?
It certainly seems like a number of lawmakers, mostly Democrat, but also some Republicans, are talking more about the possibility of impeachment. It seems that a lot of what happens next will depend on two things. First, what does President Trump continue to say about the questions regarding his phone call with the Ukrainian president back in July? Just today, the president in New York for the opening of the UN General Assembly seemed to confirm that he did indeed order a freeze on nearly $400 million in aid that Congress had approved for Ukraine. And he said, he told reporters he had done it because he was concerned that European countries weren't contributing their fair share, that the United States was going this alone. And that's a refrain that he's used before on other matters, including in terms of the fight against the Islamic State. And when talking about NATO, he hammers time and time again that U.S. allies, specifically European partners, aren't paying their fair share. So that remains to be seen how that will play out among politicians in the U.S. The other thing that could determine where this goes next is on Thursday, the acting director of national intelligence, Joseph McGuire, is scheduled to go to the Hill. He's supposed to meet with both the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee. The leaders of both committees have said that they will be expecting him to answer questions about why, when you have a whistleblower bringing an allegation of concern forward that the Inspector General for the Intelligence Community has said is both credible and urgent, why the Acting Director of National Intelligence would say it's not, would side with the Justice Department lawyers and make a determination that the Inspector General and the whistleblower are wrong. The Vice Chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner, said last week he expects during this meeting that Acting Director McGuire will have to clear this up. So how will the Acting Director of National Intelligence talk to lawmakers? What will he say? What will he do? Will he cave and release the whistleblower complaint to the congressional committees as they are demanding, or will he continue to say no and hold on to it? So there's still a lot of variables at play here to determine what happens next.
That is VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden. Interior ministers from five European countries reached a preliminary agreement on how to distribute migrants picked up in the central Mediterranean. The agreement was reached Monday during a meeting in Malta and is scheduled to be discussed by all European Union members next month. EU Migration and Home Affairs Commissioner Dimitris Avramopoulos said good progress was made in Malta toward a predictable and structured set of arrangements to deal with migrants rescued while attempting the dangerous sea voyage. Reporter Catherine Field has been following the talks. I reached her in Paris and asked her what the new arrangement means for the migrants, many still stuck on these vessels.
What it is Germany, France, Italy and Malta have agreed that any migrant, any person who is brought ashore by these migrant rescue vessels will be sent to different countries around Europe. Now, in the past, and in fact, at law at the moment, it is that those migrants would be asylum seekers, would be refugees, have to be dealt with in the country where they first arrived. So the emphasis has been particularly on Italy to process all these new arrivals. Now, it's been too much of a job for Italy. They say that they've been carrying this load along with Greece. Having to process all these new arrivals is too much for them. They've been asking now for 5 years for help from other European nations to somehow spread the burden. Now, this first step, which will involve distributing these new arrivals around some of the other countries, is really only a first step. At the moment, they've only got four European nations agreeing to it. Let's not forget there are 28 European nations that could take in these migrants. So the next step is on the 8th of October. This plan to distribute them across the bloc will go to a meeting of all the interior ministers, and it's hoping at that meeting at least 12 of those nations will sign up to this deal, which could well break the deadlock that we've been seeing in the distribution of new arrivals.
Do we know the number of migrants currently waiting to be relocated, that are some of which are stuck on these ships?
Well, at the moment there are, just on Monday, 182 were rescued and brought ashore from the Mediterranean. They were rescued from three dinghies. But when we look at the number, it is really worth remembering that this is a very small number. The numbers arriving by sea are quite small now. If we have a look at this, 60,000 have arrived by sea this year. That's well down on what we've seen before. But what we are seeing is that there is a need for the European Union to come together and do something as a group. And even though, as I said, the numbers are down, the actual fear is now that with this agreement possibly being in place and the fact that it's been so positively received by so many countries, it could actually have a detrimental effect and it could increase the number of arrivals. It could actually be a green light to more people to get on those boats and head towards Europe.
Now, Mr. Conte called for, quote, serious penalties against member states that refused to take part in this burden-sharing agreement. Did he stipulate what kind of penalties he means?
Well, that would be financial penalties. It's been pretty evident over the last few years that there are some countries within the EU, particularly Hungary and Poland, who will not take a single new arrival. They've said that their countries aren't set up for that. They're not the sort of countries that have programs in place for new arrivals. So it's really been up to countries such as Germany, France, Italy and Sweden to take in these new arrivals. So in that respect, he is looking for money. This whole program will only work if they have the funding to be able to give to those states who accept these new arrivals. And that, again, is the next problem. Yes, we're looking at Germany saying, well, they will accept some 25% of the new arrivals, but they're also expecting the EU to pay for them, and they will need to get that money from member states.
Now, how much of this migrant issue has been driving local politics in these frontline countries like Greece that have been shouldering this burden of taking in the migrants? And how does this deal affect our local politics now?
It affects it enormously if you're in the frontline nations. As you rightly say, Greece, Italy, and now Spain, and of course Malta, the smallest European Union member state. It affects local politics greatly. And we have seen in Italy up until recently there was that fierce right-wing government that said it would not accept any more arrivals from sea. Well, now we've had a change in government there. We've now got a centre-left government in Italy, and that has meant that the arrivals have been able to restart. You have a look at Greece. You know, the country is really struggling with the number of migrants who have arrived. Those numbers are well up when you see the number arriving from Turkey along through the Middle East and coming in there. They are struggling and they're going to the European Union and saying they have to be helped. You also have a look in Spain where we've got a lot of new arrivals, boats coming up through there and some just coming across from Morocco. And it really is affecting the political debate. And we're seeing that also in Spain where there's a possibility of new elections coming up. And, of course, in Malta, which it just got to the point where it had to go to the EU and say, look, we're doing what we can. We cannot do any more. And certainly when it comes to elections, local elections in all these countries, migration really is up there when it comes to the issues that the voters say concerns them the most.
That was Catherine Field. I reached her in Paris. This is International Edition on the Voice of America.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to a new study published in the journal Science, birdwatchers in the U.S. and Canada have 29% or 3 billion fewer birds to observe than they had in 1970. While the study didn't investigate specific causes for this drop in bird population, the researchers did find that a significant driving factor is the extensive loss and degradation of the bird's habitat from human activity, such as agriculture and urbanization. The study shows that 12 bird families make up more than 90% of the losses. Among the birds who have disappeared, according to the study, are sparrows, blackbirds, warblers, and finches. The study authors made their findings by analyzing bird survey datasets that were made by people who actually count the birds they see for such programs as the U.S. Geological Survey's Breeding Bird Survey and the Audubon Society's annual Christmas Bird Count. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And that's it for us today. You have been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, our engineer, Thomas Blondet, thank you so much for listening. You can find in-depth coverage of world events and news at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington. Have a great day, everyone.